I don't know if some of you experience the post-traumatic Christmas stress syndrome or anything like that, or even just a letdown. You know, sometimes there is a real just anticlimactic letdown after all the buildup to something like Christmas. It just seems like it's over so fast. Poor Marion was wrapping toys for 3.5 hours, and they're unwrapped in, what, 15 minutes max? You know, all that work. You know, so it is an interesting psychological, spiritual thing that we go through in these Christmas seasons. So hopefully everybody's doing fine and you're evened out now. And I wanted to talk to you about a few things this morning that hit me. You know, usually it seems like during the week I'm a receiver and I'm picking up all these things, and a lot of it comes from the counseling sessions that I'm doing, or just talking to people. And interestingly, this week, all of that was shut off. There was no counseling. Everything over the holidays was postponed, canceled, rescheduled, whatever. And so, come along Friday or so, it's just like, what am I going to talk about this weekend? I know we wanted to finish off the Sermon on the Mount, and we're going to do that. But as we were driving out to Cherry Valley to visit my Marion's parents and family and all, a song came on the radio. And it's a song that I probably haven't heard in maybe 10 or 15 years. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And it was Harry Chapin's Cats in the Cradle. And for those of you who are as old as I am, you probably remember Cats in the Cradle. And it was this wonderful, bittersweet song. But I have a personal connection with Harry Chapin that also just made it all that more poignant. First of all, in 1974, when Cats in the Cradle came out, 74, Megan, 1974, she doesn't remember 1974. In 1974, I was in the monastery studying to become a monk, and I had my guitar with me, though, and I remember that coming out, and in the newspaper, they printed the lyrics with the chord changes over them, so I'm sitting there in 1974 learning Cats in the Cradle in my room in the monastery in the middle of the cornfields outside of Chicago. And then 4 years later, when I was out of the monastery again and I was still in school in Chicago, I was in charge of bringing campus acts to the college. And so I and a group of us went down to San Antonio for this big convention that they have for all the acts to showcase and get you to book them, you know, for the college tour and all of that. And Harry Chapin was there. And he not only did he perform, but he did a little seminar in one of the classrooms in there, the rooms in this area. And I listened to his seminar because he was very active, an activist, I should say, social justice and social consciousness and world hunger and relief and all these sorts of things. And then afterwards, in the parking lot, there he was. And so I went up to him and I shook his hand and I told him how much I admired his work. And he was very gracious to me. You know, the blather that he hears from all his fans, a million times he heard from me, and she's very gracious. And then we parted ways, and 3 years later he was dead. He died in 1981 in an auto accident. But the body of work that he's left behind is quite remarkable. And this song in particular hit me. Because it's one thing to listen to it as an 8-year-old in 18-year-old, I'm not that young. As an 18-year-old, and it's another thing 30 years later to hear it again. When I've got two raised children, well, grown children, at least they're adults, well, they think they're adults anyway, and then two more that are still in the nest quite securely. But I wanted to read the lyrics to you, and it's going to be hard to read it because the melody's going through my head. But just listen to them, because there's something in here that we need to get at. And he says, my child arrived just the other day. He came into the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away. And he was talking for, I knew it, and as he grew, he said, I'm going to be like you, Dad. You know, I'm going to be like you. And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. When are you coming home, Dad? I don't know when, but we'll get together then, son. You know we'll have a good time then. My son turned 10 just the other day. He said, thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, let's play. Can you teach me to throw? I said, not today. I've got a lot to do. He said, that's okay. And he walked away, but his smile never dimmed. And he said, I'm going to be like him. You know, I'm going to be like him. Well, he came home from college just the other day. So much like a man, I just had to say, son, I'm proud of you. Can you sit for a while? He shook his head and he said with a smile, what I'd really like, Dad, is to borrow the car keys. See you later. Can I have them, please? And I've long since retired. My son moved away. I called him up just the other day and I said, I'd like to see you if you don't mind. He said, I'd love to, Dad, if I can find the time. You see, my new job's a hassle and the kids have the flu, but it's sure nice talking to you, Dad. It's sure nice talking to you. And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me he'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me. And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon. Little boy blue and the man in the moon. When you coming home, son? I don't know when. But we'll get together then, Dad. You know we'll have a good time then. You know, there's so much of this that still sticks to me. I think, especially those of us in the ministry, those of us as pastors, we have divided lives to a certain degree that shouldn't be divided, but there is so much attention outside of the home that it gets tough inside the home. And many pastors' children also feel conflicted about the time that their fathers or mothers spent away from the home. Not just in the pastorate, but a friend of mine who founded a nonprofit organization went through two marriages, and half of his children won't speak to him now because they said he loved children in another country more than he loved them. And it's tough sometimes to keep those things going. But Chapin is touching on something here that's really, really important. You know, how do you stay connected? How do you not defer everything out to the future? You know, we'll have a good time then, Dad. We'll have a good time then, son. You know, right now there's something I need to do, but we'll do this later. And of course, later never comes, and someday never comes. And then suddenly, you know, time is gone. And what this song to me is about, and especially now hearing it again and reading it again, is about missed opportunities. Missed opportunities. Misplaced priorities. As Jesus would say, misplaced treasure. He says, where you put your treasure is where your heart is. Misplaced treasure. And then just the relentless passage of time. Deferring into the future. And time just keeps marching on. And these young children, you know, like my 4-year-old, turn into 8-year-olds and 12-year-olds and 18-year-olds and 22-year-olds. And everything changes. And those wonderful, innocent childhood images, you know, the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon and little boy blue, all those things are gone in a flash so quickly. You know, the wallpaper comes down and posters of rock stars go up and, you know, the wardrobe changes and everything changes. The things of childhood get put away so quickly. And if we're not careful, we miss the opportunities, those wonderful little moments where we can start to know something about each other, really know something about each other. We can live a whole lifetime in the same home with other people and never really know them. It happens all the time. You know, I counsel people to whom it's happening right now. You know, they don't know each other. And what this song is talking about, and what Jesus is talking about at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, is about knowing each other and knowing God in a special way. What does Jesus have to say at the last few verses of the Sermon on the Mount? At Matthew 21, I want to back up a little bit so we can get the connection between knowing and action. At Matthew 7:21, he says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name cast out demons, and in your name perform many miracles. And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. I never knew you. As much as you may say that you have done for God, as much as you have done for your church, your religion, even your spirituality, can you say that you know God? Can God say that he knows you? And what does he mean by knowing? You know, still, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, for us in the West, knowing is what we hold in our heads, right? It's a concept, it's an understanding, it's an intellectual knowledge of some sort. But that's not what he's talking about here. The word for know in Hebrew is yada. In Aramaic, it's yada. And it means the name for hand, literally. To know in Hebrew means to be able to handle something. To know it experientially. That's what he's talking about. To have lived together, to share those moments, to not have missed those opportunities, no matter how small they are, that give you insight into who it is you're living with, who it is you're dealing with, who it is you're trying to love. To know a person that way, from the inside out, is very different than just knowing conceptually something about them. Knowing is not about the big things. Did you ever think about that? Knowing, biblically, is not about the big concepts. It's not about theory. It's not about theology. It's not about all these grand concepts that we try to hold in our head. Knowing is about the tiniest things. Just the tiny moments that you share. If you play catch with your son, how does he throw the ball? How does he scrunch his face? How does the tongue stick out the corner of the mouth when he or she draws something? You know? Your wife, your husband, all those little tiny details. If you were to prove to someone that you knew them, it wouldn't be with the large things. Oh, you're the CEO of some corporation. You're this or that. It's going to be the tiniest details that let someone know that you really know them. Knowledge is about the little things, the most insignificant things, the things that you notice when you're really paying attention. This is what Jesus is talking about. Do you know me? Have you spent this kind of time with me? Have you spent this kind of time with each other? Are you the kind of person who can even pay attention to the other person, that can move beyond the bubble of your own self-awareness and let someone else in? This is what Jesus is talking about, knowing. And then he goes on in the 24th verse, therefore, and as soon as you see therefore, you got to look and see what it's there for, right? The old saw there. There's a connection here between what? Between the verses we just read and also between this last section, this last passage, and the entire Sermon on the Mount. Everything that he has said for three chapters now is connected to this summation that he gives. You got to get that. There are connections here in the text itself. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them, that is the key phrase that you've got to hear. Everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them. Not enough to just hear them. Not enough even to know them, especially in the sense that we think, to understand them. But everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and slammed against the house, and it fell, and great was its fall. And when Jesus finished these words, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes. That kid song comes, you know what? The rains came down and the floods came up. Remember that song? And the house fell. What is Jesus talking about here? First of all, that phrase, acts on them, is what is key here to understand. There is a relationship between knowing and acting that Jesus is trying to get, that therefore connects the two of them. To know God, to hear the words of God, and to act on them is what it means to have a house that is built on a solid foundation. That when the difficult things in life come, you will not crumble. You will not fall. You may be swayed and bent like crazy, but you won't fall because there is a foundation underneath you. This is what Jesus is trying to get at. Knowing is our first step toward action. It's a critical first step, but it's only the first step. Because if we don't act, what good is anything that we know if it doesn't change anything that we choose or anything that we do? This is what Jesus is trying to get at. We've talked in here before about the psychological concept of choice theory, where everything that we do is behave as human beings. Have you heard this before? At least for me. And behavior is broken up into four parts. There is knowing or thinking, there is acting, there is feeling, and then finally there is physiology. Of those four, the only two that you have any control over is the first two. You can choose how you're going to think, and you can choose how you're going to act. But get this, you can't choose how you feel. Have you ever tried to change your feelings? When you're angry, when you're depressed, when you're sad, and someone says, snap out of it, and you want to slap them across the face? Because if I could, I would. You cannot change your feelings. You can't do it. And if you can't change your feelings, how do you change your hypertension? How do you change the anxiety attacks that you have? How do you change all of that stuff that's going on in your life that you know is stress-related, that you know is related to your thinking and to your actions, the choices that you make, that have real-world consequences and ramifications that cause you to feel a certain way and then your body to act out in a certain way? The first two are the ones that we can deal with. Thinking, knowing, we can choose that, and then we can act appropriately on that. These are the two things that Jesus is trying to get us and get us to. You know, it's not enough to merely know. But when you do know, when you really do know God, when you really do know what He's trying to transmit to us, who He really is, you can't help but act, can you? If that stuff is in you, it radiates outward. Jesus called it the city shining on the hill. How do you hide that? You can't hide that. It's visible from every point. It can be seen. When you know, you can be seen as someone who knows. You can't hide that. And you wouldn't want to. This is what James is talking about in the second chapter of his book, when he says faith without works is dead. Not that you go about doing works to prove your faith. It's just that if you've got it, if you really know it, you can't help but act it out. It's going to order every choice and everything that you do. When you act on it is the proof that you know the things of God that He's trying to transmit to you. The actions are the proof. The quality of your life is the proof. And then as the quality of your life improves because your choices improve, guess what? The feelings follow. Ever had someone you just couldn't stand in your life? And your choices, because you can't get away with them, because you either work with them or they're a member of your family, you decide to just flow with it. Kill them with kindness. I'm just going to go the other way. And what happens? You end up liking that person a lot more than you did before. Your feelings will follow your thoughts and your choices, your actions. Those two things together are the 1-2 punch, the powerful combination that Jesus is after to try to get us to understand how this whole thing works. How does this thing work? You know, the images of the house, again, were something that were so concrete to the people that he was first talking to. Maybe not so much here, although maybe not lately, with these flash floods. Have you all seen on the news these film clips of these houses being just washed away by on the banks of rivers, where they just crumble just like houses of cards? It's amazing to watch them go down. Well, ancient Judea was much like Southern California, very hilly, very mountainous, and prone to flash floods. And the flash floods would come down. The Jordan River would annually flood every year. And so images of houses being swept away in these torrents were quite common. And when Jesus talks about the house that is swept away, they know exactly what He's talking about. And when He talks about a house being built on a solid foundation, they know exactly what He's been talking about too. Because from ancient times to houses that are built today in Judea, they dig foundations about 30 feet down. If you dig down 30 feet, you get right to the bedrock in Judea. And they would throw, you know, pylons down into the bedrock, build arches from there that would serve as the platform on which to build the successive levels of the house. A house like that will withstand any sort of flood. And that's what Jesus is trying to get them to understand. Building on an image that they would tie to immediately, He's trying to get them to make the leap over to the spiritual side. Because the process is the same. We need to dig down deep into our own psyches, into our own souls, to find the bedrock of our spirits. We can't let the words of Jesus just lay lightly across the surface of our lives. It needs to burrow down 30 feet to the bedrock, take hold there, and build the foundation from the bottom up, from the inside out. Not from the outside in and not from the top down. It doesn't work that way. It's not about obedience or compliance. And it's not about just trying to show people that you have something. It's about this deeply internal thing that comes from the ground up, from these deep roots. These are the images that Jesus is bringing across. If you want to know what born again means, if you want to know what spiritual transformation means, this is what it means. It means to take the time to go deep. It means to take the time to really see other people, to see how God interacts in the moments that you have with other people, to take all of this stuff in, to internalize it, to let it seep down deep and start to build the foundations of a whole new way of living so that you become, truly become this completely other person. The old man, the old woman is really dead when this new person can start to take shape in your life. And it doesn't happen overnight. And it doesn't happen by your own willpower. It happens almost without you even thinking about it or knowing about it. It's happening kind of as a byproduct of you living your life with these qualities. Living your life in connection. Living your life really knowing the people that you're around. This is what Jesus is after. So knowing God is what allows us to take appropriate action. Why? Because when we start to know God and know who He is and know the kind of love that He has for us that can't be lost and can't be gained, we can start to act without fear. And action without fear has the freedom to be other-centered. It doesn't have to be defensive. It doesn't have to hold on to its own. It doesn't have to gather and plan for the future. It can be free just to be whatever is needed in that moment for the other person, to see those little details that make everything come alive. And in this last line here, when Jesus finishes these words and the crowds are amazed because He teaches with authority, that's exactly what is happening here. He teaches with authority and they can tell the difference because Jesus is completely integrated. Jesus is completely one. His thoughts, His actions, His whole life is the same thing. You know, you can whittle away down to the core and Jesus is still Jesus. It's like pure gold as opposed to gold plating, right? You can scrape off that plating and there's something else underneath. But with a person who is one, as Jesus was one, all the way to the core, they are the same thing. This is who Jesus was. This is what He's trying to get us to understand about what we can be as well. So, what kind of knowing then leads to this action we're talking about? We've hit on it already. Harry Chapin wrote in this song about little things, you know. The song itself came from a poem that his wife wrote years before, and it was actually about her ex-husband's relationship with his father that was very distant. The verses of the song came from this poem. But when Harry Chapin missed his own son's birth because he was on the road touring, that's what led him to write the rest of the song and put it all together. Because now it became real to him. But what he talks about are the little things, you know, throwing a ball, playing catch, the small things. Knowing in that way is what gets us to the point where we can actually act without fear, knowing who God is. And this is an interesting thing. This knowing, when you come across someone who really knows God, they look like they have lots of clarity. They look like they understand things quite well. And they always seem to make good choices. And you wonder, how can they be so clear? How can they know these things? I want that clarity. But if you were to turn it around and get inside their skin and see the world from their point of view, you'd realize they've got no more clarity than you've got. They don't know what's going on. They haven't got a clue. I think it's wonderful if you read in the book of Acts, reread that sometime, and listen to what the apostles often say. When they're trying to make decisions about what to do and where to go, there's a phrase they use over and over again, and it is, it seemed best to us to... dot, dot, dot. It seemed best to us to go here. It seemed best to us to go there, to do this, to do that. They didn't know any more than you know, any more than I know. They didn't have clarity. You know what they had? Trust. That's what they had. Knowing God in this way doesn't bring clarity. It brings trust. So that you can act without fear. And it looks like clarity to the other people on the outside. But to you, you just know, somehow, even if I make a wrong decision, I'm just doing what seems best to me after all. Even if I make a wrong decision, it's going to be okay. In the final analysis, it's going to be okay. I make a wrong decision, oh well, you know, God's not up there with a bunch of, black magic marker, you know, making X's after my name. He doesn't care. All I have to do is clean up the mess I've made to the best of my ability and chart another course. And I'll do what seems best to me at that point, and at the next point, and at the next point. And it's amazing how you can blaze a trail that goes in one wonderful direction just by doing what seems best to you when you have learned who God is in your life. That's the kind of knowing that leads to action, that leads to this kind of life that Jesus is talking about, built on a solid foundation and exhibiting all the attributes of kingdom. That's what Jesus is about. So, it looks like clarity, but it's really trust, and that's a good thing. Because what is it that we're really supposed to know about God? How do we even go about knowing about God? I mean, does that mean that knowing God, we can figure Him all out? That we can have this whole thing mapped out in our brain or in our systematic theology somehow? Now, that gets me back to Brendan Manning saying, I wouldn't want a God that I could comprehend. So, what is it that we're talking about, once again? I had a friend who was who is really going through a lot of revelations right now. It's like big chunks are just coming into his mind and into his heart, and other big chunks are falling away as he's going through this point in his spiritual life. And he had a big one the other night where he just realized that, you know, God is always there. Now, he knew that. But somehow that evening, it got deep into his spirit where he was just like, you know, buzzed, too much caffeine. He was just so excited, you know. God is always here. Every time I see a child laugh, God is there. Every time I see some good thing happen, God is there. What I asked him was, how about when something bad happens? Is God there too? And he stopped for a second. And he says, well, I guess so. Absolutely. God is there. God is always there in any moment, whether it's good as we perceive good personally or whether it's bad as we perceive bad. God is there. But God's there in the bad things? Look at what happens in groups of people when bad things happen. Look what happened to our nation after 9/11, how for those precious few months afterwards, we became one nation under God. Do you remember that? Do you remember the feeling? Do you remember the banners that hung down over the freeway overpasses? Do you remember how disparate groups who were fighting politically for generations suddenly came together and saw themselves as Americans first and all this other stuff second? Have you watched a family dynamic when someone is dying or something happens to really impact that family? And the same sort of thing happens. God is there. God is not there in what we perceive as the evil. God is there in what we see as the reaction as people pull together and become one and call on Him and find Him in those moments. Yes, God is always there. And he asked me, does God speak to you? Because I just feel like He's speaking to me all the time and all these things are coming in. It was a great conversation. I said, yeah, God speaks to me all the time. But you know what? The longer I go in this, the quieter God gets. And that seems sort of counterintuitive, doesn't it? Doesn't it seem like the more spiritually mature you get, the louder God is going to be speaking to you? But you know what? That's not the way it works. And our spiritual ancestors, the Christians of the early church and the medieval church, they understood these things. They talked about consolations, that in the beginning, the new believer had consolations. We might call it a honeymoon period, where everything is just this has this warm glow to it, you know, that gauzy out of focus sort of thing going on. And they just feel this warm, tingly, whatever, and God is just bringing these big chunks of information in. And then later on, they wonder where it went. There's a wonderful story about a medieval abbey where this one young monk is so on fire for God that he literally levitates over his brothers during prayer and times of worship. And this goes on and on and on. And finally the abbot comes to him and says, you, get down, get on the ground with your brothers and grow up. It's time to mature. It's time to understand that as your faith matures, as your faith becomes purer and purer, it becomes what St. John of the Cross, a Spanish mystic of the Middle Ages, also called the dark ray of faith. He said, as my faith gets purer and purer, it's if it's nothing. I remember looking at a manuscript page that he wrote, and of course it was in Spanish, and he wrote nada, which is Spanish for nothing. And he just wrote, nada, 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 nada. When he got to the end of the page, he went down, nada, 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 nada. You know, he called it the dark night of the soul, because what happens is that it seems like all these consolations are taken away. The safety net is removed. But it's just like removing the training wheels on the bike. They just slow you down. They limit you after a period of time. And so as we mature in the faith, God's voice seems to get quieter and quieter, and you learn to hear with new sensitivity all the time. Your receiver gets better, as if. You know, and I told him, yes, I hear from God all the time. I remember early on I had, you know, those kind of ecstatic sort of moments with God, and I treasure them, and I remember them as being so real. And they were. But now I understand how God speaks to me. Sometimes in preparing a message like this, you know, thoughts and relationships come into my mind that I didn't know I had in me. You know, sometimes I'm talking to a person or counseling a person, and things come out of my mouth that I didn't know I had in me. I've got the sensation of hearing them at the same time they're hearing them. And I realize, I better pay attention. This is for me too. And I recognize and I realize that's how God is speaking to me. And I lean into that and I accept it and I don't question it anymore. I just flow with it. You know, when I'm putting together a message like this and those moments come, that goes in. That's the good stuff, you know, because I know that that's God speaking to me. How? Because I've learned over time, this is how he works with me. I don't know if that's the way you're going to perceive it. You're going to find that out for yourselves as you get to know the Master's voice and how he speaks to you. But that's part of the knowing. And when you get really confident like that with that and you can trust it, that's when you can really move out and act on it. And that's the kind of knowing that we're talking about. It's getting to know the interplay between you and God and how that all works out uniquely to you. I had another friend who said he can't find God anywhere. And he's really starting to despair. He said, you know, I spent 6 or 7 years trying as hard as I can try like this. He says, I can't do another 6 or 7. I just can't do it. And he shared this in an open group here at The Effect. And, of course, everybody wanted to jump and say they wanted to help him, you know, do their best. Don't give up. Don't give up. Keep trying. Keep trying, they were saying to him. And I had to think about this for a second. And then what I wanted to tell him was, okay, don't give up. But this keep trying business, sometimes that gives us the wrong impression about what's going on here. You know, because keep trying implies that somehow we can take our salvation and sort of grab it by the throat. He said that, this friend of mine said that he went to a retreat and people were asking him, are you saved or when were you saved? And he says, I don't even know that I am. You know, this is where he's at. So keep trying to what? Grab your salvation and make it yours somehow? To keep trying implies that there's something that we need to get that we don't already have. And what I wanted to try to get across to him is as you get to know God, you realize that you already have everything there is to get. That last line of the prodigal son, you are always with me and everything I have is yours. Everything I have is yours. What part of everything don't we get? God has already given us everything there is to get, everything there is to have, spiritually speaking. There is nothing to get. There is nothing to strive for. Being saved, as we think of being saved, is really nothing more or less than realizing that you already are. Think about that for a second. You already are. You already have everything there is. All you have to do is realize it, know it, act on it. Test it. Find out how trustworthy God is in your life. Learn to trust how God speaks to you so that you know confidently that you can move out in that direction when it seems best to you to do so. These are the things that Jesus is trying to get across in just these few small verses here. But it's all about knowing first and acting, bringing the two together into that integral part of your life. Cats in the Cradle and the Silver Spoon, Little Boy Blue and the Man on the Moon. Once again, these innocent, innocuous images that Chapin uses in this song hearken us back to a time when we were children, when these types of things were important to us, when the world was this simple, innocent place, and we could rely on our parents, hopefully, to take care of the things that now we're trying to take care of on our own. simple childhood images. And what does Jesus say about kingdom? The kingdom of God is such as these. Such as whom? Such as those children, such as Talia, the person who exhibits both the characteristics of the child and the characteristics of the house slave, the house servant. To bring together that wonder and that dependence and that joy and that exuberance and that ability to just accept things at face value because they come to you. And then also the voluntary, willful submission of the slave, of the servant, bringing those things together. Talia, the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, those images bring us back to that moment when we were as simple and as innocent. And finally, Jesus tells us, don't lay up your treasure on earth where it can be lost and destroyed. Lay it up in heaven where it can't. Because where your heart is where your treasure is. Where your treasure is where your heart is. Go for those things. Seek first the kingdom. Take time to get to know each other in those small moments. See God in the tiniest of details in your life. Leave no stone unturned. Quit trying to defer to the future, to the grand thing that you have planned, or the grand thing that you think God has planned. Stop keeping your head in the clouds of systematic theology and trying to understand the movement of the cosmos. And just try to understand your own son or daughter or sister or brother or mother or father or husband or wife and how you can live with them in that kind of harmony. That's knowing that leads to trust, that leads to action without fear, that leads to a solid foundation, that leads to a life lived in complete kingdom. That's what Jesus has for us. And let's pray. Father, as we approach a new year, we know it's just an artificial line in the sand. But for us humans, it's kind of a good demarcation point, a new start point. So, Father, as we approach 2009, help us to try again, without trying, to just know you. To just really treasure the tiniest and most insignificant moments and details of our lives. To throw ourselves into those moments and details, to find you in those moments and details, so that we can learn to build the solid foundation you're talking about. Lord, we love you and we want you so much in our lives. We want to exhibit you in our lives. Help us to do that. Help us to start right now. Help us to make 2009 a transformed year. As good as 2008 may have been, as bad as it may have been. Help us to approach you and our lives in a different way this year and every year afterwards. We thank you, Father, and we love you. In Jesus' name, amen.